The theme song for the sequel cast is written and performed by Mark with a C. The sequel cast is also a proud member of the Battleship Pretension podcast fleet. You can listen to the sequel cast streaming on the Stitcher app at stitcher.com. Get more episodes of the sequel cast from sequelcast.com. Enjoy the show.
All right, listen up, man. One of them's underage, another one attacked a police officer, and I still ain't found what I'm looking for yet. Well, look, I think you're on your way to being out of business, all right? Let's see what we can fuck with next.
After the credits roll, there's always more to tell. Especially when the video sales are doing really well. From Shock Treatment to Jason X to Police Academy 6. This is Sequel Cast. And they are unsurpassed at following a franchise until the bitter end. This is Sequel Cast. And your hosts have asked that I inform you that the show will now begin.
Record. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Shit. 1, 2, 3, clap. 1, 2, 3. Hello and welcome to the Sequel Cast. The Sequel Cast is a podcast looking at films in a franchise, one movie at a time. I'm your host, Matt. With me is Thrasher.
I just got up to do this podcast. I don't know what's going on. Where's my goddamn coffee?
That doesn't sound like Eddie Murphy's laugh at all. We are doing a new series on the show, 48 Hours, and it's a little bit bittersweet. It's the last film series we're going to be covering on the Sequel Cast.
Spoilers.
Spoiler alert. There's a Shecky Spielberg might say, spoiler alert.
So if Shecky Spielberg was from New Zealand by way of South Africa.
Right. That was a poor Shecky Spielberg, and I'm the guy that invented him. So, I do want to point out the upcoming roster of episodes we have left is 48 Hours, another 48 Hours, a video game show on Mega Man X with Ash Paulson returning as a guest for that, and then a star-studded, by star, I mean, you know, past host of the show, and we got I think we have a fan set to appear on it, finale for a Sequel Cast, so that'll be... coming through the middle of April.
And we will finally reveal the true identity of the murderer.
That's right. So stay tuned for that. You know, the best way to look up all that stuff is on Twitter. I'm at SequelCast. Facebook, facebook.com/SequelCast. Let's talk about 48 Hours. This was directed by Walter Hill, released in 1982, and stars Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy was still on Saturday Night Live when this came out.
Yeah, and in fact, that was one of the biggest things, because Nick Nolte was, shortly after the movie came out, Nick Nolte was supposed to host SNL, but he came down with a flu and couldn't do it. And so that episode, they just had Eddie Murphy come up out on stage and say, and do an opening monologue and say, we promised you one of the stars of 48 Hours, so you're going to get one of the stars. And he hosted the show as any host would while he was still in the cast. A feat which I believe has yet to be repeated.
They joked about that on the Saturday Night Live 40th anniversary special.
Well, Chris Rock joked about that. Eddie Murphy just kind of showed up.
Yeah. Well, you could say that about the past 25 years of Eddie Murphy's career. Ooh, that's not really fair to say. But yeah, I mean, this film has really reminded me of how vibrant Eddie Murphy's performances used to be at one point, you know? He's not playing it safe. I mean, this movie is quite gritty. The first time I saw this, we had just moved to Atlanta, Georgia. I think I was in like fifth grade, and we rented 48 Hours and watched it as a family. Now, as much as you say, oh, that's inappropriate, my family had us watching 48 Hours as a family. Not 48 Hours. Had us watching R-rated films as a family since I was like in first grade, so I wasn't really shocked by the language or anything. But going back watching it for the show, I was quite pleased to see. I mean, this is a really solid movie. I'd almost say it's a better film than Beverly Hills Cop. I think it's a tighter plotted film.
Well, it's a much tighter plotted film. It's also sort of, it feels very 1970s. You get all this great pre-Giuliani New York stuff, and
yeah.
Even though, you know,
Well, it's not New York though, it's San Francisco.
Well, It feels like pre-Giuliani New York. But yeah, you're right, it is San Francisco. Yep. And the other nice thing is, even though Eddie Murphy's part is overall comedic and he gets some great comedy to do, it's not as if he's stealing the show and turning this cop story into a comedy every time he's on frame. There's a wonderful balance between his humor and Nick Nolte's kind of grizzliness. Although even then, Nick Nolte gets some good business in this movie as well.
Sure. I mean, the director, Walter Hill, he kind of got started as a screenwriter and kind of worked his way up the directing track from second unit director to director. Before 48 Hours, he did a great movie, The Warriors.
Cult classic.
Yeah, cult classic. It has a sort of similar gritty feel to 48 Hours. I mean, doing some research about this film, this was in development for a while. At one point, it was going to feature Clint Eastwood and Richard Pryor if it was made in the 70s, you know, and they just couldn't quite get people to, I think Clint Eastwood is the one that wouldn't quite agree on it at the last minute because he had a burgeoning director career of his own. And but that would have been a good pairing, I think.
No, actually, I actually kind of felt that as well watching this. I was like, you know, I could imagine Richard Pryor doing the Eddie Murphy part.
I mean, speaking of Clint Eastwood, you know, Men in Black originally was supposed to be Clint Eastwood and Chris O'Donnell.
Yes. Yes, I do.
That would have been awful. I mean, Eastwood in the Tommy Lee Jones part, I think, would have been okay.
I would hope in the Tommy Lee Jones part.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be like, instead it'd be like one of those like 580s movies that came out where the younger and the older body switch.
Oh, no. I'm trapped in the body of my 14-year-old son.
Time to eat some bagel bites.
Party on.
This is a weird intro. Okay.
Yes, it is. Hey, 40. Do you want to know where I first saw this?
I do.
I going into this, I didn't think I'd actually. I was thinking about it. I don't think I'd seen this before. Turns out I was wrong. I saw this when I was like 5.
Really? Because, yeah, was it on HBO and your family was watching it and you happened to be on the couch?
Yeah, we got cable. My dad was watching it. I came in because once it got to the part where Eddie Murphy is singing Roxanne while he's in prison, suddenly it clicked. And I remembered seeing that, and then I remembered everything that happened after it.
Right. I mean, that's such an iconic introduction. And allegedly, when this film was being made, you know, Paramount was quite angry at the director, Walter Hill, for making a film that was more of an action movie with comedy in it than a comedy. They wanted a softer picture, and he didn't really deliver that to them. And they said, oh, you never work for Paramount again. But then the movie was a big hit. And years later, they hired him to do another 48 Hours.
Isn't that always how it goes?
We'll talk about next week. Right. I mean, but I mean, you know, like Beverly Hills Cop, when you compare it to 48 Hours, it has some similarities to this, except it's like more of a star vehicle for Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy is a supporting role, and while it's humorous, I mean, Eddie Murphy plays a character that's a bit dangerous, a bit mysterious. I mean, let's talk about the two main characters here. This is a story of not Jack and Diane, but Jack and Reggie.
And right? This is a story all about how their lives got turned upside down.
They were sucking chili dogs down at the Tasty Freeze. I think that's how that lyric goes.
And they did it their way. But yeah, Nick Nolte
regrets,
is this kind
regrets
of...
They had a, regrets they had a few. Nick Nolte as Jack is so craggy. I mean, he's a real like racist cop. And also that he constantly has troubles with his girlfriend, and he blows her off for work. But in a way, I felt sorry for the character of Jack, because as a cop, you're kind of on call, and if you have a really important case, like you do in this, like he just can't be home as much as he wants to throw one into his girlfriend. He just doesn't have the time.
Well, he's just like wonderfully grizzled, and I love that they never like call him an alcoholic, but I love that he's constantly sneaking drinks. He's constantly pouring whiskey in his coffee. He's got that flask.
Right.
He keeps whenever he's got a second alone, he whips out and takes a quick swig from. But you mentioned the racism, and I actually was thinking about that. Is it that he's outright racist, or is it that later, as the movie progresses, he feels that he needs to push Eddie Murphy's buttons, so he starts, you know, throwing that kind of dialogue around.
he has a bit of a character arc, but they learn to love each other. I mean, I wouldn't say this movie is a romantic comedy between Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy.
Although, wouldn't that be an interesting angle for the inevitable remake?
Yeah, I mean, but in a way, I mean, this is almost like the first bromance movie in a way. Right? I mean, think of movies like I Love You, Man, or that sort of, or like Lethal Weapon, which came after this, which is very much 48 Hours, but with a lighter tone, and it's kind of flipped, right? The white guy is the crazy one.
Yeah, actually, I can see that. I mean, and there's a lot of people who kind of call this the beginning of the buddy cop genre, even though these only one of the characters is a cop.
Right, the other isn't a convict. You know, as the titular thing goes, 48 hours they let him loose for 48 hours to help track down people in the case, and that there's sparks flying between these two characters. They're fighting a lot, makes it really interesting. I mean, Eddie Murphy doesn't even show up until almost 20 minutes into the film.
Yeah,
the beginning could be from any cop movie of this era.
Yeah, they take
and
their
that
time.
There's a chain gang, and the main bad guy escapes with a big. He has a Native American sort of cohort, and they escape.
Yeah, that's actually a really neat escape scene because. You know, even though they never really set up that the Native American guy is dangerous, like you can feel this mounting tension as he drives that beat up truck, you know, by the chain gang, asking if he can have some water to fill up his radiator.
Yeah, and they don't give the bad guys much dialogue at all. I think if this was a more recent film, the villain would have some tearful monologue about how he talked about being molested as a child or something. But in this, it's like really clear. The bad guys are really bad. The good guys are less clear, I suppose. But, like, the bad guys, they're up to no good.
They started making trouble in the neighborhood.
Until one little night, Eddie Murphy got scared. He lit up a cigar and tried to get some trim at the bar.
Yeah, no, that's I love that's a running thing for Eddie Murphy, is that once
right.
he's out of prison, he is constantly trying to get laid.
What's that line of dialogue? Like, I've been in prison 3 years. Even a fresh gust of wind makes my dick hard.
Yeah. Man just needs a gust of wind. Get my dick hard. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's just so funny. And in Roger Ebert's review for 48 Hours, famously, he says Eddie Murphy's star-making moment of his career, and he's absolutely right, is the extended sequence in the country western bar.
Oh, man. No, that...
And, I mean, Beverly Hills Cop kind of plays off that sequence where Eddie Murphy walks in like he just owns the place, and he does.
It's just such brilliant swagger, you know, just coming in pretending to be a sheriff or a cop and, like, you know, waving around the badge but keeping his thumb over the photo so no one can tell that it's not his. Even though it's a real badge, they can't tell it's not his.
Yeah, I think this scene is even better than the one we see in Beverly Hills Cop where Eddie Murphy... walks in the country club, pretends he's gay to go up to the villain and says, I want to tell the guy I got herpes complex C. It's a pretty contagious. I just want to let him know if he has it. You know, it's like, but this one, like, there's racial tension, not just between Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte. And Nick Nolte's kind of like skulking around because Eddie Murphy said he can take care of it and find the information they need, but also between all the country western guys, it's a completely white club. He's the only Eddie Murphy is the only brother in the club.
Well, what's crazy is that like that nightclub, like what is it called? It's called like Sparks or something.
And, yeah, like, you wouldn't think it's a country a hit club.
Yeah, nothing
from
the outside indicates it's a country and western bar. A country western bar, which includes a woman in a white buffalo chaps and pasties, just doing like a little hoedown jig.
Well, that's part of the 80s cop staple. You have to have a scene in a strip club somewhere in the
film.
Well,
yeah, and so, but since
the Beverly Hills
Cop club,
always
they gotta
had that.
Give this bar, a redneck bar, a go-go dancer.
Yeah, the pasties, I think, are a bit of a disappointment. But,
I don't know. I found them quaint and charming.
Yeah, perhaps it works. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, that scene is just so well done. But that Nick Nolte, you know, I like that there's a sense of mystery here. You don't really know at the beginning what relationship, what grudge Eddie Murphy's character has with the main bad guy of the film.
And even then, he doesn't exactly, you know, have a grudge. I mean, the real issue is all this money. And, you know, Eddie Murphy is waiting 6 months to get out of jail. And the other guy just busted out.
Even though it's a lot of screenwriters credited to the script because it was worked on throughout the years, allegedly a lot of the screenplay was rewritten on the set the day of shooting, which is kind of the worst way to do it. So it's kind of a miracle this film comes off as well as it does. And I bet a lot of the Eddie Murphy stuff was improvised.
I can imagine that because it does seem so rapid fire, and yet they get a lot of like...
Yeah.
Although, actually, when he gives his speech in the redneck bar, isn't that pretty much a sustained shot once he gets rolling?
I believe you're right. And speaking of sustained shots, you look at the way Walter Hill, as the director, and the cinematographer Rick Waite do this film. It's very much typical of the time, but like it's a lot of really static shots, a lot of long shots. Almost, I would say, painterly compositions, perhaps not as fancy as someone like Ridley Scott, but like towards the end, I loved how you get a lot of smoke and you get the red neon and it almost gives a pinkish hue and it makes it feel very surreal.
Well, you know what I like? You mentioned that early on in the film when Nolte goes to the police precinct and gets brought up to speed on the case he's going to be working.
Yeah.
That's almost just a 5-minute sustained shot and Nolte is moving back and forth and everyone else is moving back and forth. And there's all this what had to be amazingly choreographed action and dialogue to make everything fire just right. I love seeing that level of choreography within a scene. And yet it still looks so natural and spontaneous.
Right. I mean, I noticed that the actor who's actually got his start as a professional football player, Frank McRae, is kind of the police chief captain that chews him out.
Oh, yeah.
He later basically reprises that same role in Last Action Hero.
Oh, yeah. And actually, that was when I was watching that, all I could think is like every scene where it's like, you know, the DA's riding my ass. I got complaints coming in from all over the city, and I would have your badge and kick you off the force if you were the best damn cop I'd ever seen. Like, as cheesy and cliche as that is, kind of like it. It's kind of transcended itself. And I love seeing his origins.
Yeah. He's okay. He's not as intense as the actor that plays the police chief in Beverly Hills Cop, who actually was a former police chief. Do you remember who I'm talking about? He gets killed at the beginning of Beverly Hills Cop 3, and he says lines like, "Axel, you make my dick itch." But you have to have the animosity. That's part of the formula in these things. Between the police chief and the guy, and you send him on the mission. And although you do get mission briefing scenes, they're not labored. I mean, this film is a lean 96 minutes.
That's true. And again, it's just, you know, so tight, has the right amount of action, and keeps moving forward, which I think actually helps it when you get that big reveal that they've been going in circles, where it turns out this is all about money, and it's money where Eddie Murphy's known the hiding place the whole time and knows exactly when they're going to arrive because it's in a parking garage that doesn't open until like 7 o'clock Monday morning.
Right, and they got to do a stakeout, and part of like Nick Nolte's general dickishness is he goes out to get like coffee and donuts, and as soon as he gets back in the car, he slams the car door. Eddie Murphy's sleeping in the back, and he's like startled awake.
Oh, yeah. I love how physical they get, too. That extended scene where Nolte is beating Eddie Murphy up, and Eddie Murphy's fighting back, and they're just fucking with each other with the car after. That's after
and
the
they almost,
bar, isn't it?
It is, and they almost beat each other up for a second time, because Eddie Murphy isn't revealing what his connection to the bad guy is. To Gans, I think that's the main guy, right? Yeah. And he has to, like, literally beat it out of them. But after that, they kind of bond. As happens, I mean, you know, I mean, this never happened to me, but there's certainly a lot of friends I know where they got into a fight with a bully at school, and then they became best friends afterwards. It's some weird male bonding thing that happens in a lot of these cop films where they got to... Not only is the confrontation verbal, it's physical. And the way they fight is different, too. I think that's pretty neat. You know, like Nick Nolte just does these surprise punches out of nowhere, and you see he's getting a bit winded. And Eddie Murphy is a big Bruce Lee fan, and so he tossed in a lot of karate moves. I don't know if you noticed that, but a lot of kicks, right?
Oh, that's true.
In the fight scene. So you have two different contrasting fight styles and then kind of work with the character. Eddie Murphy is a fast talker. He's also a fast fighter. Nick Nolte is a bit lumbering, but when he hits hard, and he plays dirty. As one line of dialogue goes, like he says something along the lines of, I got to tell you something, Watermelon. I fight dirty. And then he cold cocks him, Eddie Murphy, in the side of the head and slams him against the side of the car.
Yeah. Oh, actually, speaking of playing dirty, what did you think of the villains here?
They're okay. I think the, you know, they're character actors, right? They have really grizzled faces. They look convincing as criminals. But because there's so little development, I mean, this is really a film from the point of view of the cops.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it reflects that. Had you had an actor like, oh, I don't know, Christopher Walken or Brian Dennehy or something, as one of the, it would have popped out so much. And it adds to the, I guess I'll say realism. I don't know if this is a really realistic film necessarily, but it adds to the grittiness of the film with the actors they did as the villains. I don't think they give great performances, but their looks say volumes.
Well, I think what works is, you know, we see them until the final confrontation. We see them the most during that escape from the chain gang, and from that point on, we only ever see them around when they are going to encounter the police, and there's going to be a big confrontation. So that's you know, kind of cool. It does help make them seem more villainous. But Sonny Landham, who played Billy Bear, who I think did a really good job. I noticed apparently he started out in pornography until he ended up in The Warriors.
Is that the Native American?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, interesting. Well, I mean, that's not a comment. Sylvester Stallone started in one of his first roles was acting in a party at Kitty and Studs.
Yes, Kitty
and Studs. Which was, because at the time, like, porno films, and I know younger listeners might find this hard to believe, but at one point in the mid to late 70s, am I right in those dates? I think, yep. I'm pretty close. Pornography was considered like it was going to be a mainstream thing. Like, you know, like your mom and dad would dress up to the nines and go to the theater, go to the adult theater and see a porno together. And that was considered a pretty randy evening.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, they would talk about it on the Tonight Show, and it wasn't just like a joke. It's like, you know, erotic film was gaining mainstream acceptance, and it came so close. And strangely enough, I feel like the reason why it went back into the shadows for so long, it really has nothing to do with Moral Crusaders and almost everything to do with the rise of home video.
Right. I mean, there's that, and there's also, you know, I heard this mentioned on an interview on Inside the Actors Studio, and I think it's right. Deep down in the United States, you have like a history of a lot of conservative religion and like the Quakers and that sort of thing. It deep down, America as a country is quite squeamish about sex. And that's reflected in the 80s, you had a lot of nudity in film. But like in the 90s, it got pretty cut out. In like modern day, like even more so, you get a hit like an erotic thriller every like 20 years, like Basic Instinct, yeah, or 50 Shades of Grey.
And I got to say, I have no problems with sex. And in fact, if you all could see what I was doing right now, you would be horrified and titillated in equal measure.
I'd say he was flogging the bishop, but that'd be a bit raw.
And the bishop liked it.
As he knotted his shiny helmet, he went for a constitutional. God.
I don't know if you know what human genitals look like, but actually, although there's actually a decent amount of nudity in this film, we get a lot of stuff with some prostitutes and the criminals early on in the movie, and then the two women, their love interests, I believe. We get some of that at the end.
Yeah, like at first I thought they were lesbians, and it's not entirely clear that they aren't. They could be bisexual or something. Like, I just sort of got that vibe. But that one of them was seeing the, you know, they each were seeing the criminals that escaped at the beginning. And they can't, and when they try to go in to interrogate them, they try and beat the shit out of Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte.
Well, because Nolte and Murphy look like they're breaking into the apartment.
Right, but as a police officer, if you think you're in a dangerous situation, like, you have that right to an extent. And certainly in the 80s, people didn't have, but there weren't even cell phones. Where, you know, it's not like everyone had a little camera on them.
Oh, but they could have used Polaroids.
Yeah, had a Polaroid dangling around the neck.
That's Yeesh. Where I keep mine.
Yep. No, but I mean, I was just really shocked how well the film holds up, with the exception of the score by James Horner, who later is famous for Titanic and stuff like that. It's a very 80s score.
It's very 80s, but I found it worked. I mean, it was perfectly integrated into the movie itself, as dated as it is to modern ears. I think it is the perfect score for this film.
And the score to Lethal Weapon is a big knockoff of like this music.
Yeah.
It sounds very similar, the smoky saxophone.
You know what this movie needed? It needed a love ballad, like at the end of Lethal Weapon. 48 hours to love you. Something like that.
And 48 hours to leave you.
Baby.
That's 96 hours altogether. How are we going to spend it? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's why I don't don't do karaoke as much anymore.
It's the world's loss.
I suppose, you know, it's... We know a guy that hosts karaoke at a place, and it's a bit of a drive to get there. And when we go, we tend to go to his place. Hey, Chris Green, if you're listening. anything else about 48 Hours? I think we've done a good job discussing the film. I think the ending, the action kind of ramps up, and you have an okay car chase and a really good sort of climactic confrontation.
Yeah, there is a... Yeah, it's just a nicely brutal gunfight. It's just a nicely brutal shootout with real physical consequences. I love that.
And I appreciate you have kind of a running thing where it's revealed that Reggie Hammond, Eddie Murphy's character, got screwed out of a lot of money by Gantz, and he gets the duffel bag of money from Gantz, but then, you know, the police have to turn it back in because Reggie has to go back to prison, I think, for like a year. And he's asking, you know, Jack, how much will I get early in the film? And Jack is like, well, you know, it's on the merit system. It depends how well you do. And then they sort of come to an agreement at the end, which I thought was a real sweet moment.
And Nolte presumably is going to take care of Eddie Murphy's sports car. I love that Eddie Murphy has that nice, sophisticated European sports car that was his wheels that they left in long-term parking.
Do you think Eddie Murphy was convincing of being threatening in the beginning of the film?
I think, I think he was successful in playing a guy who can fake being threatening.
Because I think a lot of bluster.
Yeah, I think that is Eddie Murphy's. His character is bluster, is swagger, is putting on these deceptions in the moment. So I think like he plays a guy who can project that stuff, even if he is not really much of a physical threat himself. Also, he must be the most hated guy in that prison. Just if what that's what he spends his days indoors doing is just singing along to a Sting album on his Walkman.
It would have been the police, but yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And you look at the other writers, a lot of them later became directors, you know. The director, Walter Hill, worked on the script. Larry Gross has worked in a few Walter Hill projects, but Roger Spottiswood would later direct Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, and he also directed the James Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies, which isn't half bad for Pierce Brosnan Bond. Also, one of the writers, Stephen E. D'Souza, better known for Die Hard, and he also directed the first live-action Street Fighter movie.
Oh, that's right.
Stephen E. D'Souza also wrote the worked on the script for Beverly Hills Cop 3. If you want to hear that, go to sequelcast.com. Listen to some of the archives while you still can.
That was
I'll explain that part.
Oh, so that was the third episode, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also one of our first sequel commentaries.
That's right. It's the only film where you can hear the Axel F theme played by trumpets, and it's a sad, sad thing to listen to.
But you can wash that away with the Wonder World anthem.
Yeah, that's a good number, actually. But 48 hours, I give it 5 out of 5 stars. Listeners to the sequel cast know I rarely do that, but I think it just... I don't mean this is a pun, but it fires in all cylinders. it's just real solid. One of the first, if not the first, buddy cop movie ever made. It still holds up today. I think the running time really helps it. You know, had the film been 30 minutes more, it would have felt a bit laborious. Oh, yeah. It just gets straight to the point, a nice, clear, simple, direct plot, and there's nothing wrong with that.
I'm gonna be right there with you. You know, 5 out of 5. This movie did everything it needed to do. I knew I was going to enjoy it. I really suspected I was going to enjoy it. I like young Nolte. I like young Eddie Murphy. I love everybody involved in this movie. But I came away from this truly loving the movie, kind of on the same level that I love a Die Hard.
And as a teaser, I tried to watch the first 5 minutes of another 48 hours and almost fell asleep, despite the fact it's a lot of the same creative team. But we'll have more to talk about that next week. So let's do pitch a sequel. I think what I would do if I was picking up at the end of 48 hours is I would call it 49 hours. And it would be, you know, pick up right where the first one leaves off. So presumably it would be made, you know, in 83 after this film was such a big hit. And right as Reggie, Eddie Murphy's character, is dropped off in prison, he puts on the Police album again. Instead of singing Roxanne, he's going like a Message in a Bottle. In fact, that would be the opening credit sequence. Is Eddie Murphy singing Message in a Bottle really hilariously on his Walkman as we see brutal footage of a police guard at the prison getting murdered? So you have some irony going on there. And then you see some explosions go off. Everyone from the prison is freed. San Francisco becomes a fucking madhouse with the jailbreak. And but Reggie is free, and he's trying to find Jack just to get his money and leave. But meanwhile, unbeknownst to Jack, Reggie knows something about the guy that caused the jailbreak. So it's a similar concept, but kind of to the nth power, because you have a whole lot of criminals running around San Francisco, and cops are getting murdered everywhere. And Reggie just wants his money. 49 hours is what I would call the sequel.
Well, I think I'd do the next 48 hours. And in this one, you know, Eddie Murphy, you know, he finally, you know, gets out of jail. He's got a clean record. He's going to go on, live a good life with that money. However, turns out their little criminal gang who was responsible for the big robbery that got them all the cash from the first film, turns out there are a few loose threads. They ambush Nick Nolte, who's on the way in Eddie Murphy's car to pick up Eddie Murphy and give him the money, and they steal the money.
Got it.
And
oh shit. Okay.
And in the process, they kill a cop and make it look like Nick Nolte did it. So as it was, and Eddie Murphy finds him.
Got it.
And so what happens is they have 48 hours to get back Eddie Murphy's money, and Eddie Murphy's going to split it with Nick Nolte at this point. And they also have 48 hours to clear Nick Nolte's name, because everyone in the police department, because Nick Nolte is such kind of a wild card, they've all been waiting for him to slip up. Everyone within the police department turns against him really, really quick. So it's this whole cross-country race to get the money, to get the real killer, to clear Nick Nolte's name. Because, like Eddie Murphy says, look, I'm not going to become a cop just so I can get you out of jail for 48 hours so we can do some sort of case or something. We got to take care of this shit now.
That's what you call a titular line, ladies and gentlemen.
God, look, we got another 48 hours, Watermelon. Let's just get this done. Yeah, Watermelon, you think that's funny. How about I call you Whitefish or whatever?
Yeah.
They could have some real back and forth, really have them play off as equals now that they're he's out of prison and Nick Nolte is wanted.
I mean, I've seen tilapia before, but this is ridiculous.
Hey, let's go back to the bar from the first one. And actually, I would have them meet one of the people from that bar again. But it turns out, because of what Eddie Murphy did, the guy turned his life around.
Look at that dancer. Last time she had a B-cup, now she's double D-cup. She didn't trade it up. Got a super combo.
Welcome to the late 80s.
God, I should never do Eddie Murphy impressions. Yeah, we're running a bit short on time here. I will save sequel news for next episode.
Okay.
Let's do what you're watching.
Yes, indeed. Tell me what you watching.
I was on vacation in Atlanta, Georgia recently. Got to see Horrible Bosses 2.
How was it?
Not bad. Not great. Like, just okay. Which is better than I expected. I thought the first Horrible Bosses was just okay. And this one, Horrible Bosses 2, kind of does what Hanover 3 does. In that it makes it more of an action film, like a heist film, than a comedy. And because of that, the plot is a bit convoluted, but Chris Pine is really good in a supporting part. They try to cram in too many cameos of people from the first film for no good reason. Christoph Waltz is really awful in this film. He's not good at all.
That sucks. I generally really like him.
His part is fairly small, and then like he just doesn't quite have the comic timing. Yeah, so, but I think it has its moments. It gets better. Actually, the beginning of the film is pretty good, and the ending is pretty good. It's a bit labored as it moves through its paces. You can see it huffing and puffing a bit, but like not bad. It's okay. Like, if there's nothing else on, or if you have a Redbox and you can rent it for $1, it's perfectly worth $1. I'm confident in saying that much. You don't need to see the first one before you see this one. Although it helps, so you kind of know, like, why the hell is Kevin Spacey in this movie? Because they don't set it up really well if you haven't seen the first film. The Horrible Bosses 2 did very poorly in the theater.
It sounds like it deserved to.
I think it's just, it's mediocre all around. And you rarely get comedy sequels. I do not think we'll be getting a Horrible Bosses 3.
We're not for a few years when they're desperate for a franchise.
They just want to get the box set. What have you been watching, Thrasher?
Well, I've mentioned it before. I'm a big fan of Community, and the new improbable, even more improbable season of Community has begun.
I saw those for. I saw at least the first two episodes of that as well.
Yes.
So, what do you think of it?
Well, you know, I'm glad to have it back. I do still feel that some Community is better than no Community. The first episode is not as laugh out loud funny as I'd like to be, but it pretty much just exists as a meta way to connect the original run of Community to this run of Community. However, the second episode, the lawnmower maintenance
it's quite
and
good.
Postnatal
yeah.
care, was fucking brilliant. Just their systematic takedown of depictions of virtual reality in film is amazing.
And it was co-directed by Jim Rash, who plays the dean.
Oh, yes. And of course, also introduces Keith David as Elroy Potashnik, who's going to be a recurring character. I think, like, I was laughing nonstop, although I think my favorite part was to calibrate your virtual reality system, look at the back of your hands, then look at the front of your hands, then feel a sense of wonder.
I think... As hard as it was for Donald Glover and Chevy Chase not to be on the show... The loss of Shirley in the latest season is a real low blow.
True, although and, I love yeah. the send-off they gave her. I did not see that coming.
Yeah, that was...
The Butcher and the Baker coming this fall.
Quite funny. And you know, it was for personal reasons she wasn't able to do it.
Which they even, I think, I believe, commented on.
Mm-hmm. So... I'm glad, you know, the production value of, not that Community had much production value for the except for the special episodes, but it looks just like Community. And I think the Netflix stuff has certainly proven that. This one happens to be Yahoo. But I was a bit nervous, you know, when they said Arrested Development a few years ago, season 4 on Netflix. And, like, they can put the budget that these things need, even for internet TV shows. So we've come a long way. Since, you know that SNL sketch with, like, Jimmy Fallon with some jack-off on a webcam?
Oh, yeah. Well,
these things look and sound professional and are getting real money, even if it's probably less than what the budget would be for TV.
And you know, hopefully this will finally get the networks to concentrate on producing quality content. They, of course, won't, but this is the perfect time for them to do that.
Did you see the Kimmy Schmidt show on Netflix?
Yes, I did. I fell in love with that real quick. I watched the whole thing in one day.
Wow, I've only seen half of it. I think it's really funny, and it has a surprisingly dark premise to the show.
Oh, I know.
And I love that the theme song is done by Sonify the News guys.
Well, I know, and that's something else I love, is that the theme song for the show is a song that exists in the world of the show.
Right, and that, you know, I think it's something like NBC was supposed to pick it up, and then I don't know if they paid for some of it and then just had Netflix do it.
They did. It was originally going to be primetime. Then they kind of, like halfway through production, demoted it to like a mid-season replacement show, and then just decided to pull it for whatever reason.
I think it would have been a bit weird for network television standards. Not only, I think on Comedy Central or HBO or something that might have picked it up. Like on Comedy Central, I was watching what's the name of the show? Damn it! It has two females in the lead.
Broad City.
That's it, Broad City. And you have jokes about a whole episode about how one chick smuggles her pod up her vagina, and it gives it a certain scent. Like that's so damn weird, and like that's on Comedy Central. Like Kimmy Schmidt is kind of along those lines, perhaps not as crude. But
I feel like that's the perfect reason for why it should be on network television. It's like a market for weird, sophisticated comedy is a market that they are not supplying at all.
No, you just think of 30 Rock and all the Cable Town jokes, you know? Like it's.
I don't think those were jokes. I think those were cogent observations.
Yeah, I mean, it's the online stuff, at least as of now, gives you more freedom.
Absolutely. And I love that they're already working on the second season, so I'm very much looking forward to see where that goes. I also love that they hold off on the reveal that John Hamm plays the cult leader.
Yes. I also love that Netflix is getting, after all these years, finally, a new Pee Wee Herman film that's produced by Judd Apatow. It's going to be a road movie. That's all I know about it. They posted a picture from the movie, but it was just Pee Wee Herman in a car. So it doesn't tell you anything. Let's do Paul Goebel Memorial Mashup.
Yes. This the penultimate Paul Goebel Show Memorial Mashup.
Yep.
This mashup, I'll just jump right into it. As always, I take two horrific impressions, whip them together into one impression, and Matt and our guests have to figure out what it is. So are you ready?
I am.
All right. George, there's a rumor spreading around. In that Texas town, there's a shack outside LaGrange. Do you know what I'm talking about, George? Just let me know if you want to go. That home out on the range, George. They got a lot of nice girls out there. Have mercy, Lionel. Oh, George.
Is it Harvey Firesteinbrenner?
No, although I'm curious to see how you came to that conclusion.
It sounded like Harvey Firestein to me, and then I seem to recall there's a character on Seinfeld named Steinbrenner, although I couldn't tell you who I think was George's boss.
He was at one.
Perhaps I'm mistaken about that.
Yes, although I don't know how you got there from this. No, this was Wheezy Z Top. This was a Wheezy from the Jeffersons singing LaGrange.
I would never have gotten that one.
Well, I hear it's fine. Oh, George. Yeah, that's, you know, that's why I tried to drop in a lot of Georges and Lionels in there.
Went right over my head. So for the sequel cast, this is Matt.
This is
catch me on Twitter at SequelCast. If you're in the Portland, Oregon area, Tuesdays, 8 to 10 p.m., I host a quiz for geeks who drink at the Iconic Lounge, Tuesdays, 8 to 10 p.m. If you're in town, check it out.
Yes, and you can follow me on Twitter at InternetMayor. You can also follow me and support me on Patreon at Willie T. And regardless of when or where you are listening to this podcast, as always, you can find me at Origins or Gen Con running LARP events under the banner of Kettle of Fish Productions.
Have you ever done a Kettle of Fish production where you bring a literal kettle of fish, like, let's say, fish sticks?
You know, No, but we actually had we have some business plans for the next 2 years, and one of the things we had considered if we get a vendor booth at a major convention was we were actually kind of as a promotional gag going to have fried fish there. We weren't going to sell it because that would violate the vendor agreement. Nothing against giving it away.
Interesting. One last thing I'll point out. Have you seen the pictures of Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor?
Yes, and he looks like Michael Berryman from The Hills Have Eyes.
He has a huge forehead.
Yeah, he looks like he doesn't look like Lex Luthor. He looks like the Absorbing Man.
He looks a bit like I don't know. You know, he looks like he clearly lost some weight, and it was his sort of, you know, his afro thing going on that covered up a lot of his head.
You know, I'm seeing just another scowling jackass. I want someone in this movie to look like they're having a good time. I want the charismatic Luthor like we got in the animated DC universe. I don't want another grizzled bodybuilder whose superpower is just gonna turn out to be punching like everyone else in Zack Snyder's movies.
You know, there's going to be a scene in there, I bet, where Lex Luthor punches... Oh, why did I say it like the old movies? Mr. Luthor. Lex Luthor punches Superman in the chest. And then Superman stands proud, and then all of a sudden he grabs his chest, and he's hurting. And Lex Luthor opens his fist to reveal he was holding a rock of kryptonite inside his hand.
Assuming they bring kryptonite into it...
Don't you have to? It seems like most of the films have kryptonite.
Well, I mean, they're perfectly willing to play fast and loose with the mythology, and make no mistake, it is mythology, but I don't know. This is a movie that at this point I'm not looking forward to at all, so I don't know. Like, I might never see it.
I wonder if we'll get a plot in which Lex Luthor, I'm just making this shit up, but I could see them doing something this stupid, goes onto Superman's ship he crash landed on Earth and finds the DNA of his father, Jor-El, and resurrects a evil Jor-El to fight Superman.
Yeah, although I kind of hope that it's just another crooked real estate deal.
No.
Yeah,
That's the worst part about the Bryan Singer Superman.
He's going to buy up some cheap land in the middle of nowhere and then trick some supervillains to almost ending the world, but doing it in such a way that it ends up creating luxurious beachfront property out of his useless land.
You know, I think for it to be a real kind of Superman film, it needs a 20-minute opening credit sequence in space. With the 3D letters popping out towards you. That's the only thing I liked about the Bryan Singer's Superman Returns, is the opening credits, which are a complete homage to the credits in the first film.
And they're thrilling.
Unlike the opening credits in Superman 4, Quest for Peace.
Less thrilling.
So next week, we'll be talking about another 48 hours. To stay tuned about what's happening with the sequel cast and stuff, for now, like, Twitter at SequelCast is the best place, or the Facebook page, facebook.com/SequelCast. But I will say, download the episodes while you can.
Absolutely.
Before they're gone. So this is Matt.
This is Thrasher.
Saying,
Roxanne, you don't have to put on a red light. Sell yourself for money. You don't care if it's wrong or if it's right.
And in the morning, we're making waffles.
God damn it, Eddie Murphy. Just let me get a couple more hours sleep. Give me a shot of that. I don't need waffles. Just give me some whiskey for my breakfast. I got the work to do. God damn it.
The Sequel Cast is a Hipster Goblin production.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.